feels quite good being back in the UK. Now, let me introduce the panellists I have with me today. They've all been on a journey. Professor Rupert Reed, ploughing a fairly straightforward academic furrow in philosophy at the University of East Anglia, but he moved to the United States for work in the very early 90s and found himself absolutely shocked, really for the first time at his home, at the extent and the severity of the environmental degradation he saw around him. And he found himself in the end swept up by a movement on the West Coast to save the redwoods, to protect reckless and unsustainable logging of the redwood forests there, the Earth Forest camp he was a part of. When he came back to the United Kingdom, he got involved with the Green Party. It's a long-standing relationship. 3 books later, and he's stepping into the role as Extinction Rebellion spokesman. You'll see him all over the radio and all over the television from Easter, when Extinction Rebellion really made its presence in the kingdom. Next to him, we have, of course, Roger Hallam. Now, before he crashed into our consciousness as one of the front of house of Extinction Rebellion, He, and delivering rebellion to households across the United Kingdom, he was quietly tending an organic farm in Carmarthenshire and merely delivering vegetables. So it's been an interesting journey for him. He was researching radical political change at King's College and working with other organisations on campaigning strategy. Finally, on the far left, Mark Lopatin, who had... finally, but not but not finally, a 16-year friendship with an Adele, of which we'll hear more in a minute, years working as a journalist in print, a hired gun then for environmental organisations and Royal Dutch Shell, so quite a broad sweep of professional engagement, but his moment of his catalytic moment in recent years was sitting down with his friend Professor Jim Mendel and reading his paper called Deep Adaptation, and that was a moment for him where he felt that he had to change course and engage in a different way with his professional life and what else he did with his time. So thank you, the three of you. Professor Jim Mendel, let's explain a bit. In 2018, Professor Jim Mendel came out with a paper called Deep Adaptation, a paper that was almost immediately labelled as too depressing to read and summarised by people as probably pretty much we're fucked, get used to it. Now, Deep Adaptation was a wake-up call. It's become a metaphor. It's become a phrase that means a lot to people. Can I ask all of you, in turn, to explain to me how depressed it is in what you do?
Yeah, thanks, Anita. I'll make a start on that. And here's how I explain it. So, we're all on a plane together. We shouldn't be on this plane, but we are. We're all on a plane together, and this plane is going down. The only question is what kind of landing it has. Are we going to crash and burn and there'll be nothing left? Are we going to manage to have a few of us surviving and maybe making something better, more long-lasting out of the wreckage? Or are we going to manage very, very quickly to repurpose and rebuild in flight and have a relatively soft landing in which relatively few of us have to die? Do you understand me? This is exactly our situation. This civilization is going down. It is essentially over. It's like one of those cartoon characters that has run off the... The only issue is how we are going to land. Jim Mendel is a colleague of mine. We've published together and we'll be publishing more together. And what he argues is that it is certain that the plane is going to land pretty badly. The possibility of us doing the repurposing, the sudden repurposing in the air and landing relatively softly. I agree with him that that's very, very unlikely. it's very, very unlikely that, roughly speaking, Extinction Rebellion is going to triumph rapidly and we're going to make it in that way. I don't think, however, we know that it's impossible. I think it's still worth trying. That's my main disagreement with Jem. But where I profoundly agree with him, and the reason I work together with him, is that I think that because it's unlikely that we're going to make it relatively intact, it is incumbent upon us to seek to deeply adapt. For what deep adaptation means is, the idea of deep adaptation is that we have to be ready for that rough landing. That means things like, for example, on the macro scale, it means things like you need to find a way of making safe turning off the nuclear power stations that we have, of making safe the nuclear waste that we have, for a time in the future where it is quite possible that there won't be any organized state or whatever to take care of it. And on a more small scale level, it means things like you have to adapt mentally and you have to adapt your community to the reality that all of this that we are accustomed to is likely to come to an end. And there's another aspect of this as well, and another reason why it's very important for us to consider it, in the context of Extinction Rebellion, and it's this, that part of what it is to tell the truth, and that's Extinction Rebellion's number one demand, about the situation that we're in, is to be honest, in the way I just thought, to be honest, and to say, this civilization is finished, we have to try to prepare for a possibly quite nasty end to it, we have to try to make sure it isn't even more nasty, and we have to try, in the time that we have left and with the resources that we have, to see if we can manage to find a way of stopping that nasty end from happening. And when you go in for deep adaptation, you say, we need to be doing things like shutting down our nuclear power stations because it's absurd, it's completely insane to have nuclear power stations all around the coast ready to be overwhelmed by rising sea levels, etc., at a time when we cannot guarantee that our civilization is not going to collapse. So deep adaptation is part of what it is to be honest in the situation that we're in. It's part of what it is to tell the truth. That's a really, really important dimension of why we need to be talking about it, as I hope we will do this afternoon. Perhaps that's enough to start with.
It'll do. Thank you, Rupert. Well, Roger, geographically you're next in line, so why not?
Hello, hello. I'm not going to stand up because it's a bit hot. So, I read Jem Bendel's paper a little while ago, found it quite invigorating and annoying at the same time. It was invigorating because I think it was one of the first few times, anyway, an academic in the system, as it were, who's been honest enough to describe in some blunt and understandable detail why we're fucked in a really serious way. And I've had the dubious honour of being at King's College, for instance, for 5 years. And it's one of the biggest secrets in academia that everyone knows this, but dare I say, academics are quite cowardly. There's no other word for it. And they don't want to tell the truth, along with a lot of groups in society. So it's very invigorating to actually see a mainstream academic actually come out with what is obvious if you look at the climate science with a fairly, you know, clear mind, as you might say, for maybe 10 hours. I think that's as long as you need. So that was good. And I think it relates to Extinction Rebellion because Extinction Rebellion has come out of a similar sort of explosion of consciousness on the edge of society anyway, where a critical mass of people have decided that they don't want to be lied to anymore and they don't want to lie to themselves anymore. And this has led to the honesty of Extinction Rebellion and its success in mobilizing 100,000 people in 9 months. So I think both are part of the same phenomenon, which is, to get a little bit intellectual, in complexity theory, if you have a system and you put pressure on that system, it holds together and it holds together, and then suddenly it cracks, it bifurcates. And what happens is most of the system goes into greater denial, as it were, into greater conventionality, and a small amount of it, of the system, or the people in it, go towards systematic change. They change into another phase of being. So this applies to physical systems, natural systems, and human systems. So it's no surprise to me that this is what's happening around the world at the moment, is most of the system is burying its head in the sand, you know, like a lot of the people who are in this tent. And the people in this tent are the outliers who have decided that they want to know the truth and try and deal with it. So where I sort of get annoyed, as you might say, in a certain sense, with Jim Bendel, is the conclusion he draws from that, which is that we just need to adapt. And debate justice, he obviously does say that direct action is one of the options. But for me, in my value system, direct action is the only option for anyone with any civic responsibility. I can't ultimately sort of criticise people that want to do nothing, because, you know, we're only on this planet for 70, 80 years if you're lucky, so who am I to say? But I am quite happy to pin my beliefs to the mast, as it were, as a old-style Republican, as you might say, if you know your political theory, which is that when a society comes under threat, it's the duty and the obligation for citizens to rise up as a collective force and maximise the probability of survival and future prosperity. And that's what I do.
Mark, you can liberate the microphone. You can wrest it from its mount and make it your own.
Hello, everybody. I'm like these two. I don't speak very often, but that's part of this moment. And I do have a story to share you today. In fact, listening to Roger, I think I had my moment of complexity theory. I was sat with Professor Jim Bendel last October, not long after we published his paper, and I translate really clever people. That's what I've done down the years. A bit of a court jester, agitator, ghostwritten for lots of people, politicians you might loathe, like, I don't know. And I was doing that with Jem, and I was going through the paper, and a bit like Roger, I got to the end, and I was like, oh, crikey, that's not much of a punchline, is it, you know? And it wasn't until a little while later that I was having a coffee, a soy milk latte, and I stirred it in a nice white mug, and I sort of realised something that maybe I'd sort of known all along. I sort of went through the ingredients, and so there's the soy milk, obviously, and I think, well, that's better travelled than me. And there's the chocolate dust topping, that's better travelled than me. And there's the coffee, and that's better travelled than me. And I think even the mug might have come from China. And what I began to realise was that it's actually a lot worse than what Jem had actually spelled in his paper. And I say this with a certain degree of caution, because it's not easy to say. You know, you're at a festival, as much as you're looking to educate yourselves, so looking to have a good time. But I stared into that coffee, and what I saw was, I saw something much more near term. Because, and I've really been looking into this a bit lately, and I've got some help, and there's this thing called just-in-time delivery, just-in-time inventory, and that little coffee that was sat before me was the result of this incredible human feat that is the global economy. And whether we like it or loathe it, we think it's pernicious, nefarious, elitist, and leaves billions of us behind, which it clearly does. The things that come to us in this beautiful orderly sequence, a bit like Tetris if you've ever played the video game, I just suddenly thought, that we're not going to need rising sea levels and shrinking glaciers and 2 degrees or 3 degrees to bring us down. And when I say us, I mean all of us here. I mean billions of us who live in urban areas, because we don't make anything, we don't grow anything that sustains us. We are totally dependent on remote humans and natural inputs to feed us. And this just-in-time philosophy, it's incredible. It's grown up over the last 30 years. It's this religion around efficiency and savings, profit maximization. The accident is, while the scientists have been telling us for the last 30, 40 years, largely on deaf ears, what's coming, the people that feed us, the people that clothe us, corporations, and the governments that manage this, have put this awful, awful Achilles heel. So if you've ever seen Star Wars, you know what the Death Star is, when Luke Skywalker fires the phaser and it all goes boom. That's a little bit like what I fear this just-in-time supply of essentials is going to do to us, because it's so fragile. And Mother Nature need only pinch with extreme weather, which she does today. And we're watching the plight of millions of people living in the global south. They're being devastated already, but it hasn't quite come home yet. And I don't think this is the stuff of 10, 20, 30 years, which is how climate is often framed in the science and the modelling. I think this is coming really soon. And I worry that there is no resilience and that we're not prepared. And I know we have more time today to explore this, and you know, there's thinking I want to share with initiatives that Extinction Rebellion are providing an invaluable space, and I'm very fortunate that through people like Roger and Gal Bradbrook and several others here, that I'm able to open up a little bit of space around this vulnerability that doesn't get written about. It isn't in the modelling. Climate scientists don't really go around talking about just-in-time inventory. But the people that feed you, that's all they look at. They're deaf to the science. They're following their quarterly targets, their bonus targets at Tesco's and Cargill and logistics companies you've never heard of. But they're carrying your calories 24/7. And, you know, I don't have a good news story for you today, but that was my awakening. I believe there are things that we can do, and I'm going to shut up now because we have more time to discuss them. Thanks.
It's fragile. The academics know and they're not saying. The companies know and they've got a vested interest in not saying. The world is in denial. And you guys are trying to start a revolution. My experience of revolutions, having witnessed a few, is that they burn the house down. If it is so fragile and the lives of all of us are in such terrible imminent jeopardy, then aren't you endangering us more by creating the seismic waves that you are trying to do? Start of a 10, I don't mind who leaps in first.
Look, before I address that directly, Anita, let me just underscore, just in case it hasn't fully landed for you or one or two others in the audience, just how bad the situation is and how in need of some kind of radical response it is. So, here's a statistic that may be of interest to some of you. The greenhouse effect, how does it work? Right, you burn some petrol in your car engine, yeah? And that produces intense heat, yeah, that makes the engine work. And it also releases this carbon into the atmosphere. And that produces the greenhouse effect, yeah? The carbon stays in the atmosphere for decades. And each day, it warms the Earth up a little bit. It traps a little bit of extra heat. The statistic is what the ratio is between those two things. Take a moment to think to yourself what you think it is. Do you think that it's about the same amount of heat that additionally gets trapped in the atmosphere as the heat that was released from burning the fuel? Do you think it's 10 times as much that gets trapped in the atmosphere? How bad is the greenhouse effect? Let me tell you the answer. 60,000 times. Right? That's why we're fucked. 60,000 times. You produce this intense heat from the petrol. The carbon released from that same petrol traps 60,000 times as much heat in the atmosphere over the following decades. Fossil fuels are weapons of mass self-destruction. The government is planning on us achieving carbon net zero by 2050. So we're in an emergency, and for the next 31 years, they want to make that emergency worse by putting more of these weapons of mass self-destruction into the atmosphere. So unless we do something extraordinary, that plane is going to crash, and very few people, if any, are going to survive. So what Extinction Rebellion are seeking to do is to say, okay, how do we do something about this? As Roger was saying, and I was saying, and this is also what Mark has in mind, as he'll tell you in a different way, we think that telling the truth about this is the absolute starting point without which we can't get anywhere. And we are going to carry on telling the truth, and we are going to be rigorously non-violent, whatever happens. And part of the hope, and this is coming to your question, right? Part of the hope is that if you tell the truth, and if people can trust you, and if you're rigorously non-violent, as we have been absolutely so far over the past year, then hopefully we can avoid some of the pitfalls of the previous revolutions that you were worried about.
One of the main sort of criticisms is you're going to make it worse by trying to make it better. So that's correct. That's all I can say on that one. except that if you don't do anything, it's almost certainly going to be worse. So this is when the penny drops, sort of, for people in Extinction Rebellion, and also historically, is when you realise you're going to get hurt anyway, so you might as well put yourself in harm's way, and society's going to get hurt anyway, so you might as well risk that society will get a little worse in order to get it a lot better. And historically, that's the tipping point for people that go into rebellion, is when they make that realisation that it's not like go and get arrested or keep my career. It's I'm going to lose my career anyway, so I might as well go and get arrested. That's the moment of action, as it were, and that's in a way why Extinction Rebellion has the slogan "When hope fades, action begins," which is true to a large extent. And so it's a question of weighing up the realities, as it were. And I think the main reason we have got 1,000 people in this tent, and why there isn't 100,000 people on the street yet, but never say never, is because most people are still haven't emotionally engaged with the reality of society's annihilation in the next 10 to 20 years. And it's totally understandable. And the methodology Extinction Rebellion is to create the social disruption to make that more real. Because when you've been in your car for 3 hours in the heat because you can't get through because Extinction Rebellion is blocking the road, then two things happen, one or two things. You either polarise towards greater opposition to Extinction Rebellion, or you start to realise that this shit is real because you are embodying it and you're emotionally relating to it because you can't get to work. And that's how radical social change works, is by creating emotion and embodied disruption. It's not a cognitive process. And that's the plan, I guess, to make it real before it's real.
Mark, you're a communication strategist. Extinction Rebellion was almost unknown last year. It burst into our consciousness by Easter. It was on everyone's lips. Councils declared climate emergencies up and down the country. Children felt extremely validated in the stance that they had taken. And actually, physically, legislatively, apart from some fine rhetoric, you could call it hot air, not a great deal has changed. Where is Occupy now? You know, it's just another of those protest movements. It's going to fizzle out. Nice idea, but really?
Okay.
Okay.
She's like one of those BBC journalists.
What is this? Okay. I'm going to let you into a secret, first of all. Some of you might know this already. But there is no emergency. Okay? So now you see The Guardian writing about it. Global heating emergency. Parliamentarians. The emergency. Politicians wearing Extinction Rebellion badges, piggybacking on their well-deserved cachet. But there is no emergency. There is no emergency because it's the wrong kind of emergency. We have to do everything now so that we might offset something later, something uncertain, something we don't want. So as a communication strategist, sounds quite grand. As a former journalist, I've got another secret for you. This climate story, it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all, and it's never worked. So what, that 200 and something years ago, humanity unknowingly gave planning permission to Mother Nature to build a greenhouse. And she's putting the last couple of panes in the roof as I speak. It's true, but as a story, it doesn't work. We check out, and people, you know, all of you will know why. All you know, we don't want to know. Cognitively, as Roger says, whether they're climate scientists, NGOs, politicians even, we're trapped in this incrementalist straitjacket. And my third secret is, the messenger doesn't work. So the scientists, talking about the scientists, the NGOs that I've just mentioned, they don't work. So as a journalist, there's two things I've been scratching my head about. A news story, one that's personal and drips with risk. Something you can imagine happening to yourselves and your family, not in 20 to 30 years, but in a few. And who are you going to believe? You're probably not going to believe Roger, me, or Rupert. You're probably not going to believe the NGO that you have the direct debit with. Or the politician who says things because, you know, the ratings make it good. I think I know who you're going to believe. And it does come closer to the idea that I'm working on with Extinction Rebellion. And I believe that when XR talks about rebels, for example, as some of you may be aware, you may be members of XR, but the rebels are the people that put themselves in harm's way, as Roger's described, that are going to make the sacrifice to be arrested. Or in some cases, like Roger, go to prison. To show everybody how serious this is. And I support that. But I think that's just part of who you might believe, such that you sit up and you really, really believe what's coming. And I think those voices are also rebels. But they're invisible, and you're never going to meet them. And they're never going to be sat in Marble Arch or Westminster come October. They are people that work inside the system, so-called. They're people that work inside corporations, the food companies especially, the reinsurance companies who hold all the intelligence about extreme weather and where it may hit and what damage it may do. And the idea is, and listen to Roger really carefully, because the permission is coming for people inside these machines, people inside this system of ours, to be whistleblowers, to start leaking their truth, to tell you exactly where the food chain is, to tell you exactly where the risks are, when they might come. Because right now, we don't know. And the investors in these companies don't know. There's a kind of strange dance that no one wants to know. But if I have any hope around accelerating consciousness and bringing people to a point of action, which Roger is describing, it's because the system tells its own truth. We can't do it. We're not going to be believed. But if we can get people inside the system, we can give them permission, which is why Extinction Rebellion is so important, and the other movements, which are going to hopefully line up with us in October, we can send a signal. And these whistleblowers are the most powerful rebels of all. They will never be thanked. They will never be known. They don't get to sit down in solidarity with the rest of us in October, and hopefully many of you will come if you can. But that for me is the key. Because if we can get the system to tell its own truth, and we can turn that truth into a feedback loop in its own right, then maybe, just maybe, we can build some resilience before the events hit.
I'm letting you guys make speeches because you're saying some interesting things. Just saying, you know. I was one of those BBC journalists. That's the problem. Now look, if I can pick you up on your Star Wars analogy, Mark, because it's useful. The Empire strikes back, man. You're going to have a backlash. There's going to be not just a carefully placed political backlash. We saw the policy exchange report come out on you from the think tank, the right-wing think tank, that we then find out is funded by, partly funded by energy interests, but they called you extremists. It's a label that sticks. From that comes legislation that makes it harder and harder for you to do your work. You know what happens when you get labelled a terrorist, then a whole bunch of things click into place. There's going to be anarchists and troublemakers who show up in your movement who may actually not be lovely, genuine, high-minded anarchists at all, but have been put there because someone wants trouble to be made. You know the fight is going to get dirty. Are you ready for this? Do you have a strategy for this? Because this is what's coming. This is the pattern. This is what happens with uprisings from the Middle East right through to here.
Okay, I'm going to answer this in half and then going to hand over to Roger, because I don't organise rebellion. I'm not part of actions, and Roger is the brains behind the theory of change. But there's something really important in your question, Nisa, and there's something really beautiful in XR that I think I can respond to, is that what XR did to me, mea culpa, right? I didn't get arrested, right? I haven't been arrested. And I wandered around rebellion in April, a bit of a sourpuss. What's the point? You know, here we are, I sat on the bridge. These people aren't like me. I'm not really triggered when someone gets arrested. Oh, what's the point? And then, the penny started dropping so much that I needed a bloody helmet by the end of that 10 days. Because the answer to your question, Nita, is in the first demand. It's tell the truth. And what XR is doing, in my view, it doesn't get talked about much, is it's actually holding a non-physical space. It's not just about the physical spaces that Roger and others are building strategy around, that Roger will tell you all about if you didn't hear this morning. For me and many others, there's a non-physical space which you can't regulate, which you cannot shut down, which you cannot take back. And that for me is because the truth cannot be owned. And if you can create a space and you give permission for people around the world to do a very courageous thing and disclose. They can disclose to a journalist, they can go to the OCIJ, they can go to WikiLeaks. We will be setting up a gateway of our own. It's going to be called truthteller.life. It's going to be with us in a couple of weeks. But this, for me, is where my optimism is. Because no government, no corporation can put a stop to that. And it's because XR can open that space, and people like myself can find a tiny part of that to work with, that I believe, Anita, this is impossible to stop. It's impossible. But with regards to the physical side of this and the shape of rebellion, that's for this fellow.
And Roger, martyrdom's all very well, but WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is in Belmarsh and we don't hear anything from him now, and that's what happens when the system decides to shut you down.
Yeah, okay, so this is like a boring BBC question, in my view, which is to like ask a question that has a sort of message behind it, which is there's no point doing anything. And that's what the media is obviously, interested in. Is getting beyond the rhetoric and the depression all the exuberance and actually look at the facts, look at the research, look at the historical evidence in the whole. Don't cherry pick. Anyone can cherry pick and choose something that's really depressing or really amazing. They don't count. What you need to do is do a whole system analysis. Look at the whole system and see what works, and then design a maximal strategy that maximizes the probability of a win. So there's no sort of certainty here. Civil disobedience in the 20th century worked 54% of the time, according to Erica Chenoweth's research. Not a great stat, right? But what's the alternative? In the practical world, we have to choose between suboptimal options, right? There's not another option out there which definitely will deliver us. There simply isn't. It's called real life, okay? So the best option is mass participation, civil disobedience. And if you want to maximize the probability that it will work, then you have to have nonviolent discipline and you have to train people in why that's important. People don't naturally get it, which is what Extinction Rebellion set up to do. As far as the state stamping on you is concerned, yeah, that is a problem. But it's also the pathway to success, because when the state and the authority stamp on you, then there's a backfiring effect that often kicks in, which is that people feel sympathy for your cause and join you on the streets. Doesn't always happen, but it often does. And you maximize it by maintaining nonviolent discipline and be willing to sacrifice yourself. So that's the theory of change. Very challenging for our culture, which is very cynical, very challenging for people on the left that love to hate people and want to be moralistic. But that's what we're doing. And so far we've mobilized 100,000 people. So it's in the ballpark of being a winning strategy. That's the plan.
We are going to take questions from the floor. I know you've got many. Rupert, you had another point you wanted to make before we open
the
discussion up.
I think the theme which is coming through from what all three of us are saying again and again is it's about telling the truth, not shying away from facing this terrible reality that the reason why we need to start deeply adapting is because on any objective assessment of the situation, the likelihood is that this civilization is going to collapse and stuff like that. And it's the same with the media. And here, although I agreed with everything that Mark said a couple of minutes ago, I disagree with something he said earlier, which is that we can't be the vehicle. I think we are a crucial part of the vehicle. I think that one of the reasons why Extinction Rebellion is doing so well is that a hell of a lot of people out there trust us. They trust us to tell these absolutely blunt truths. And that's one of the reasons why we're getting a lot of traction against the media, which often continues to be quite hostile. So when I went on the Radio 4, for example, to defend Extinction Rebellion and defend Roger from the accusations made by Policy Exchange, I took that line absolutely resolutely, and I got John Humphreys on the back foot by asking him questions and saying, why aren't you asking who's funding Policy Exchange? Why don't you do your job? Why don't you, the media, do your job? And I think a hell of a lot of people out there are with us and are cheerleading for us because they don't trust that media, and they trust us. And I agree with Mark that we need the next thing, one of the key next things we need to do is get a much wider group of people out there telling the truth about all the stuff that we've been trying to hide for so long. And that's going to keep on blowing the ordinary media narratives out of the water and causing them no end of trouble.
Thank you, gentlemen. Do we have a microphone to roam around the audience with? That may be the sound of it. We should start, and if we can't hear you, I'll reframe your questions on your behalf. This gentleman in the purple shirt over there, stand up, and if we can't hear you, I'll restate what you've asked.
My question is about the role of business or the potential role of business in the rebellion.
The potential role of business in what?
In the rebellion that we're talking about.
Right.
You mentioned earlier energy interests opposing Extinction Rebellion. And I'm from the renewable energy industry, and I think a lot of us in the solar and wind industries, we would like to feel that there is a role for us in what's coming. And standing next to you guys, so my name's Jeremy Leggett. I founded a solar company, Solar Century.
Hello, Jeremy Leggett. We know who you are.
And you know, many of us in my company, we don't have anything organized, but you know, my head of marketing is a member of her local group. I was on Waterloo Bridge, you know, doing my thing for a day as an ordinary citizen back in April. And so, let me just ask the question. We haven't felt particularly welcomed by the movement, and there was this effort to, you know, put a group of companies together to stand full square with XR via a letter to the Times. That was probably really badly handled, looking back. But, you know, it's the point about rebels within the incumbents, rebels within business and helping you out. What, as a business leader, what's the single most important thing that I or anyone else in business could do to make sure that we do the best job we can collectively as citizens in Extinction Rebellion?
Did you hear Jeremy clearly? Okay, well, what is the single most important thing that people in business can do, especially business who understand where Extinction Rebellion is coming from and share many of your concerns? What is the single most important and constructive thing they can do to help Extinction Rebellion get to the next stage? That was the question. Is that fair enough, Jeremy? Okay. You want to start? Okay, go over it.
Because I've just got a few quick things. Thanks so much, Jeremy. Good to see you here. I've got three things. Firstly, I think the XR business kind of thing was mishandled, as you say. But the letter to the Times was brilliant. Letter to the Times during the rebellion from business leaders saying, we support Extinction Rebellion. Wow. I mean, nothing like that has ever happened before. And that was superb. So let's have more like that. The second point I would make is do what you do, Jeremy, but many business leaders don't, which is tell the truth, right? You've got a regular blog and so on and so forth where you put stuff out about what's happening in the energy world and in the solar world and so forth, and about how terrible things are and about how they can get better and so on. We need lots of businesses, any businesses that are sympathetic with us, we need them to be sort of permanent whistleblowers, if you will, in that kind of way. And the third thing, forgive me for saying it, but to quote Bob Geldof, give us your fucking money. we would love to have more money from persons like yourself to do the extremely important work that we're doing, still on quite a shoestring compared to any of the established NGOs.
Mark, I mean, he's not quite the insider in business that you need because he's already on side, but presumably he might have friends who aren't yet.
Yeah, Jeremy, we don't know each other. Hello. I'm interested in your Rolodex. I want to know who you know, and I want to know who the people you know, because we need lots of help in getting under the skin of target sectors of the global economy. Energy is one of them. You obviously know a huge amount about it. It's not good enough that we treat the fossil companies as villains in activists and campaign circles. We really have to understand where the bottlenecks are, where the risk to supply will come from. And if you know people that can explain that to some of us, and if you know people that would turn around to the industry as respected figures in their own right and say, you know what, it's okay, you can disclose, you can do it safely, you can do it anonymously. Because, you know, to go back to Rupert, no one's gonna listen to me to make that plea. I don't think those people are going to listen to XR, quite frankly, although we will make that plea. But coming from someone like yourself, whistleblowers will view you differently. They'll view you with a respect, a safety, and you have a power there. So if I ask you to do anything, it's to maybe dwell on that.
I hate to not be pluralistic. I love pluralism, but I'm no longer a pluralist. I think we're in a crisis and we're in an emergency. And in a crisis and an emergency, there's one thing that has to happen, which is there has to be a crisis in the state. The state is the primary institution that defends society historically, because it has the monopoly of violence and it has the decision-making power to make the rules of society. So when a society is about to enter into a crisis, there's only one question: who controls the state? And Extinction Rebellion has made this big structural move from moving away from pluralism to a very reductive aim, which is to close down central London until the regime starts to crack. And that's the only thing, it's the only thing that is going to enable some structural change in policy, is when there's an overwhelming pressure on the interests of the elites that are taking us to our deaths. And that's a very difficult argument to make. I've spent most of my life being a pluralist, being involved with trade unionists, animal rights, permaculture, you name it, I've been involved in it. But all that doesn't matter anymore. What matters is, does the government in October come to the table or not? And every ounce of our effort should be focused on creating the maximum amount of disruption in order to attain that objective. Because that's the door through which everything else that we want is going to open up. And unless that door doesn't open up, then it's all wishful thinking. It's all what we've been doing for the last 30 years. So that's it's a brutal thing to say, but we're in a brutal situation. That's what I think.
I'll take your question in the front there, Lily.
Hello, my question's for you, but really for anyone. So if we took the hypothesis that you were elected as the Prime Minister tomorrow and you were able to put all of your comrades and team into Cabinet enthusiastically supporting you, could you just summarise for me in very simple layman's terms of sort of one or two actions that you would take to have the maximum impact straight away?
I had a question very similar to that on my list too.
Okay, yeah, so let me have a quick go at that. And really the answer is implicit in the Extinction Rebellion three demands. So the demands are, number one, tell the truth. Number two, Britain carbon net zero by 2025, not 2050. And also halting biodiversity loss by 2025. And the third demand is... Getting there. Third demand is we want citizens' assemblies to decide how to get us from here to there. So in other words, we're very different from, for example, a political party, which will lay out a full manifesto and say, well, here's what all the things we're going to do. What we're saying is, and if you will, if I was a kind of XRE prime minister, what I would say is, right, I'm not going to decide everything today. What I'm going to do is to hand it over to the citizens together to decide how to do it. And one of the reasons we do this and say this is because we think that there isn't enough trust in the conventional political system to make people have enough will to actually go ahead and do the things that a prime minister or whatever says they want to do. Remember, prime minister can't just wave a magic wand and everything they say happens. They have to actually make it happen. And what that means is millions upon millions of people have to make it happen. So what the Citizens' Assembly will do, if we get the kind of thing that Roger was saying in his previous answer to a previous question, what the Citizens' Assembly will do is decide on what all the various things are that we do to get to those objectives in demand too. Having said that, I'll say one more thing, which is that it's pretty obvious what some of those things would be. And in particular, it's obvious that if you're going to achieve carbon net zero by 2025 and halt biodiversity loss by 2025, then there's lots of things that you simply cannot do. So I'll start with some of the really obvious ones. You simply cannot carry on expanding airports, right? And in fact, you're going to have to put that process quickly into reverse. But it's just obvious, it follows directly from demand two, that we're going to need to stop airport expansion overnight. We're going to need to stop HS2, we're going to stop road building, we're going to stop the expansion of intensive agriculture. All those things which make things worse, all those things have to be stopped like that. And that's not going to need the intelligence of a citizens' assembly deliberating, advised by experts, to achieve it. That's just obvious. So some things are obvious, but the details, there are different pathways in which we could reach this very, very difficult objective. We want the people to decide those. And we think that the idea that politicians or parties can decide them for us is an idea that is no longer viable.
Roger, do you, or Mark, do you want to add to that at all?
Well, just to say that, like...
what a deeply adapted society looks like.
Well, I wanted to say...
Roger's talked a lot about process, not about outcomes. What you wanted to say?
Yeah, I'm going to say what I want.
Yeah, you say what
I want. I'm getting more confident in my old age, aren't I? Yeah, forget the question. What I wanted to say was that this isn't some incidental sort of add-on, the Citizens Assembly. It's central to the strategy of creating a semi-decent transition. You know, we all know what the default is. The default's going to be fascism in various forms. That's what's going to happen if we fail. You know, the strong men are going to take control and they're going to shoot people to maintain their power, and it's going to be the 20th century all over again. What Extinction Rebellion is holding out for is a progressive transition. And the essence of a progressive transition is democratic legitimacy. It's all about the political sphere and whether that has legitimacy in the population. And the research on this is very clear, that when you have deliberative assemblies selected by sortition, that's a randomized selection from the population, then it's like ordinary people like me are making these decisions. And that has a profound legitimizing effect. And that's what we need more than anything else at this stage, is to get the whole population to understand this is what's necessary. It's not an imposition by green dictators. It's either this or fascism and chaos. And if we can, the best way of putting that through to people is to have ordinary people discover that for themselves through this deliberative process. So it's a key element of maximizing the possibility of something semi-reasonable happening.
For those of you who are interested in this process, we're going to have a sort of mock citizens' assembly here tomorrow afternoon on the programme.
I will mention at this point, we're up to 54 minutes, and these panels are meant to last an hour. But we've got a half-hour buffer zone. How many of you would like this discussion to continue? Because we've only taken two questions. Do we feel... have you got the stuff? I only saw one person nodding off in the front row. You're awake now. That's good. That's good. Well done. So shall we push on? Shall we push on? This okay. So let me take a question from the back. Yes, that woman in the sunglasses over there.
Okay.
There might even be a microphone. This is your augmented reality. Make the most of it.
Right. Okay. My question is that it's a really interesting dilemma for me, because Extinction Rebellion, when you're kind of talking about the world's fucked, there's a kind of feeling like you could go two ways. One is, well, the world's fucked, so I might as well party. Or, as the conversation started to go to, well, what might this new world look like, be transformed into, there was a different energy. And I think that sometimes when the energy is really negative, then the response can be, just, you know, you begin to fade out. It's like, can't do anything about it. And it's really important to empower people. And I'm not sure that the words extinction do that.
Let me make a start on that, and I'm sure colleagues got stuff to add to that. Look, that's your response, and maybe that's the response of some other people. I think the evidence on the ground is that we're kind of doing quite well. Right. I heard someone quite experienced in the NGO world saying after the April Rebellion, "My God, you've achieved more in 2 weeks than we achieved in 20 years." And I think what we've done, one of the things we've done, is we've proved that the idea that, oh, if you tell a negative story and if you talk about doom and whatever, then you're just going to turn people off. We've proved that's wrong, right? Many, many people have been motivated as they've never been motivated before by the idea that actually here finally are some people willing to say, you know what, we're sending other species extinct at the rate of one every 10 minutes. That's five already during this talk. And we might send ourselves extinct. And Christ, this is totally unacceptable. I'm going to rebel against this. The evidence suggests it's working, and that all those who said it can't be done, you have to tell a positive story, you have to talk about progress, you have to make people feel good, they're wrong. But look, where you're totally right is, it's not enough to just do the doom, and that's where some of us have some concerns about some of Jim Bendel's messaging or framing. And what we have is a really, really positive message of various kinds. One part of it is, I tell you, there is pretty much nothing so empowering as stepping into a road or whatever it is and saying, oh, wow, we're all here together and we're starting to have a party and it's against the law and we can just do it because there's hundreds of us. It's enormously empowering and liberating to do nonviolent civil disobedience. In a good cause. And then there's the question of, as you were also getting at, how we're trying to create a better society. And the first thing to say about that, I think, is that any of you who are in London in April will have experienced a little tiny bit of that society in real life. You know, if you were on Waterloo Bridge, if you were at Oxford Circus, it felt like here is the new society starting to be made. And the second thing is that, of course, what we're trying to do, and we've been starting to talk about this, is talk about how that can be done on a macro scale as well. But just to go back to where I started, I think we always have to have both sides of it. There has to be the beautiful, positive vision that we're trying to create. And there has to be the threat and the grief and so on and so forth. Because in the final analysis, most of us are doing this for our children or our nephews and nieces or for the next generation in general. Because what they're doing, what the climate school strikers are doing, is they're begging for their lives. Yeah, they're begging for their lives to have a. They're begging for the right to have a life at all. Yeah, and we have to look that horror in the eye and then flip it around into something beautiful and positive. I think we have to have both.
Take a question from that gentleman over there in the black t-shirt. The microphone is on its way to you.
Yeah, great. So Anthony Hobley, until April I was the CEO of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, so the Carbon Bubble Stranded Assets people. And I mean, two things, yes, you know, I've been doing climate for 20 years and what you guys have done in a year is incredible. I think one of the things we've discovered in interacting with the financial markets over the last 5 years, it's, you know, it's not just fear. Fear is really important, but it has to be fear and hope, and that's what gets the traction. My question is, you know, I think, you know, we've got to a point where we've got the technologies, and actually in many cases they're better now and they're cheaper than coal, oil and gas. But we're still, you know, people are still choosing to build more expensive coal-fired power stations or gas power stations. And I think what you're doing is you're empowering those internal activists, or the conversations I've had with senior people in banks, asset managers, even some oil and gas companies, is they talk about what you're doing in glowing terms and you're empowering them, but still not enough. So how do we get that willpower where we can roll out the technologies that we have and that are cheaper, but at scale? How do we get over this kind of potential energy barrier, if you want to use a chemist's term? And how do we go to that next stage of empowering society, business, governments to actually roll out the technology that we actually have that we need to do at scale?
Mark, you know about red oil, I understand.
It's been a while. I really hear you, and I think it just necessarily takes me back to why aren't these things happening, right? They're not happening because the story that you and others, and including myself on occasion, have been telling hasn't worked. Hasn't moved the public, hasn't moved the market, hasn't moved governments. So there is all this innovation. This is the tragedy in all this for me. And you make a really good point that there is so much innovation that's going on around technology, about community innovation, which Jen Bendel talks a little bit about in his deep adaptation, you know, framing about the key questions we need to ask ourselves. There is a huge amount of work going on around inner work. When one thinks about the denialism and the awakening that actually responding to this moment entails. I mean, think for a moment. I will bridge back to what you've asked. But in this country, we're asking 60 million people to gently put down their way of life. That's you and 59.99 million others. Okay, globally, it's 7.6 billion. Okay, and maybe a billion of them live like us. I don't know the actual numbers, but there's going to be several billion people who we're going to ask to gently put down the aspiration to be just like us. But that's not going to happen unless we have a story that sticks. And the people that can help tell that story are in those companies, are actually our frustrated activists working on solutions and innovations that the board or the boss of their department doesn't take seriously because the rate of return is not right, it doesn't meet the investment criteria, so they have to scribble away and be frustrated. I want those people to come forward and disclose. I want them to bring it down so that we can move on to the disruptive innovation, so that business can transform itself and start building the solutions that the best part of 7.6 billion people are going to need happen, and happen quickly. I'm totally agnostic about what those solutions are, about how we redistribute, about how we stay fed, about how we innovate in the face of temperature rise. But until we get off this, you know, I call it going to hell in a hybrid, right? It's that, you know, we... No. But there's a real frustration in me in your question, because I think so much of the answer is locked up in what you say. And that innovation will never come to... It won't scale. So we need people in your world to come forward and call it so that we can all see where we're going in the next 5 years and we can all shift. You know, and what Roger's put forward is one way of doing that. The truth teller way is another. We need more weight. Sorry, I'm getting very animated, aren't I?
Animated.
I'm getting to breathe quite a lot.
We'll take another question. The lady there.
I think I know some views on. Obviously, we're asking the government to tell the truth, so we're still recognising that there is a role of formal politics in a way, other than, you know, eventual societal collapse. I guess this is directed at you, Rupert. Last year, I joined Extinction Rebellion and the political party that most resonated with my views. Within a couple of months of each other, I'm now a district councillor for the Green Party in Folkestone and Hythe, and I'm now the parliamentary candidate. I guess, Rupert, this is maybe for you. Do you still maintain hope that formal politics is a valid thread? I mean, for me, XR, the messaging has really informed what I've done so far. At council, we did our climate emergency last month. I was on BBC Radio Kent yesterday morning talking about the Select Committee report about people giving up their cars. And I did an interview. It was really... successful, sort of talking about quite radical adjustments people need to make in their lives, and this is perhaps related to giving up our sense of normal. And so for me, I'm quite new to the climate movement, but it's all happening at once, and all the languages feeding into each other, formal and like top down, bottom up. Do you maintain hope that that's a valid path?
Absolutely, I maintain hope that it's a valid path. However, do I maintain hope that it's going to be enough? No. So that's where I stand. Like you, I'm in the Green Party, and I stood in the European elections recently. Extinction Rebellion is beyond politics, beyond party politics. What we are trying to do in Extinction Rebellion is to make what seems politically impossible, possible. and to shift the entire Overton window, as they call it, to boot it from one place to a completely different place, yeah? A gigantic consciousness shift, which is going to mean that it's impossible for political business as usual to continue. And unless something like that happens, then ordinary party political activism is not going to be enough. So if there's a general election soon, I'll be supporting the Green Party, and it seems obvious to me that the Green Party is the best way to go of our existing political parties. But do I believe for one second that the Green Party is going to make it by itself or even as part of a coalition or something to the level that we need to make it to without something like Extinction Rebellion? No, I don't. I think that the kind of transformation that we need is so huge, so rapid, so unprecedented, that it's only going to be conceivable if we move people across the whole political spectrum, and if we also go beyond the ordinary representative democracy system altogether, and in the kind of way that Roger and I were describing before. In other words, what we need is, sure, better politicians to be elected, but what we also need is for the people to be empowered through something like citizens' assemblies. That's the only way it's going to be enough. I hope that answers your question. Thank you very much for it.
Roger, when you look at the existing political system, do you see any friends out there?
No.
You'd say that.
I like saying those single word answers. I like that. I think that it's not the issue. The issue is to maximise disruption in the shortest amount of time and then see what it throws up and then ask the question afterwards. Obviously, it's conceivable that the British, like, political class will come to its senses, but I doubt it. What I personally put my hope in is ordinary people around the country deciding they've had enough. And generally speaking, they have had enough already. So it's a matter of mobilising them and changing, fundamentally changing the political system so it becomes a more deliberative democracy, as we've discussed. But, you know, at the danger of repeating myself, because I am a bit of a one-point guy, really, is, you know, without disruption, nothing is happening. And so, 7th of October, write it down.
I'm going to take one more question and then we're going to wrap, because I sense we've reached peak excitement. This gentleman here with the glasses.
Thanks very much. My name's Mike, and we did a thing called techtheuk.com. We're fighting Brexit with tech, and we're entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and evil business people. But so I hate to be the person in the room, and I really apologise to everyone. Everyone's going to go, oh God, he's asked that. But what comes first? Is it going to be easier to do what you want to achieve outside the EU or in it? And what comes... obviously, I appreciate your mission is to do exactly what you said on stage over and over again, but is it going to be... Not, I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated and I'm a supporter, but is it going to be easier if we're in the EU or is it going to be easier out? And what's your view on that subject? Sorry.
Can I give a short non-answer?
Yeah, I was just going to say thanks for bringing Brexit back. We've been talking about Brexit for 5 minutes, and
sorry. You know, I reckon one of the reasons why we did so well in April was everyone was like so bloody relieved that finally they could talk about something else. So my short non-answer, and there's loads to say about your fascinating question, but we don't have time. We literally don't have time. George Monbiot put it very well, and he said, the Brexit issue is really important. And this issue, the climate and extinction issue, it's approximately 1,000 times more important. So let's spend 1,000 more times talking about it. Spend 1,000 times as much time talking about it. That seems to be about right.
Roger, you've got 1,000-yard stare.
Well, I want to say something
I don't think I have a choice anymore. We're wrapping up this discussion.
Well, I just want to return to the Jem Bendel theme about this total crisis and how we're going to respond to it. And obviously we've been saying, yeah, disruption and all the rest of it. But I think there's another sort of fundamental piece, which I think Jem Bendel does sort of draw up on a little bit, which is we're going to have to change the way we look upon life and death. And our culture is very unusual. It's a total outlier because it's very utilitarian. It's very superficial. It's very egotistical. It's consumerist. It's individualistic. I'm not necessarily saying for the sake of argument that's bad, but it's completely inappropriate when you're dealing with an existential crisis. And we need to rediscover our traditions of what it means to have a sense of public duty, what it is to have a sense of who you are over and above an individual consumer, an individual career person, and all the rest of it. So what that means is we need to stop thinking about what it means for me and what it means for my career and all the rest of it. We need to start thinking about what is it that we have to do to be human, to be a citizen, and to be a good person. You know, when we're on our deathbed, what are we going to be thinking? We were sitting here in this tent today, and what did we do? You know, this is the critical life question for most people throughout history, is what did I do and did I make a difference? So I want to leave everyone with that point, you know? I mean, everyone's lovely and everything, but we're in this fucking crap situation, right? And we need to start growing up collectively and doing what we have to do. And if that sounds like a little bit tricky, it is, you know, because we all know we're not. So, as I said, 7th of October, 10 o'clock, don't be late. Thanks.
Follow that, Mark.
Good as well. I'll have a go. I'm gonna try and make it a bit easier. I'm gonna just. This is kind of how, you know, to evoke Jem in his paper again. You know how I, you know, it was a bit of a simpleton when I sort of translate. You know, really clever people and social scientists, people like Roger, people like Jem. That the way I got to my bottom line, and I'll leave you with this, is that I looked at it through Mother Nature's eyes, right? And she's in a rush, right? You know, 10 years ago, we thought it was all 2050, 2100, 20... No, she's in a rush, and she's coming at us like Mad Max waving an eviction order. And we haven't got a lot of time. And there's a poetry in that threat for me, in the chaos that she threatens all of us, because it's going to come so quickly that it doesn't matter whether you're Elon Musk or Richard Branson and you're figuring out how to get into space. So if you read Ben Elton Stark years ago, you're... kind of know what I'm talking about. This happens too quickly for the richest of the rich to get into the heavens. So if you've seen the film Elysium, they're not going to get there in time. And what that says to me, and this is the poetry, and I guess this is the inner work that Roger was paraphrasing, it says Mother Nature sees us all as one, regardless of what we believe, what we look like, who we think we are, all those things. We are one in her gaze. And the quicker we get that message around the globe, and the closer we get to bringing that home, then the nearer we get to what you've heard today about what follows that truth, which is not a space I know a huge amount about, but there's a really basic piece of arithmetic here. And, you know, that's the bit that, you know, I go to bed thinking about and I wake up thinking about. So there you go. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate it.
We're going to really briefly get the last word again.
Just this. The truth has force. If anything has landed with you this afternoon, then, as Roger and Mark in their different ways have said, please make sure you draw the requisite consequences. And at minimum, I hope that means that pretty much everyone who's still here after this fascinating hour and a quarter will also be on the streets in London, standing side by side with us on October the 7th from 10 a.m.
Thanks to the panel for
a more profound discussion than I could possibly have hoped for, actually. I'm moved and impressed. So thank you. You lot have been deeply adapted now. So go forth and be profound. And to help you on your way, there's some books on sale on that table over there, which might prove a manual. That's you. That's you. Which might prove a manual for your route. Thank you all for coming. See you at another discussion.
Can I just announce we've got a green climate workshop starting at 4:30. So if you feel affected by this talk, you can join Meg in the training tent for a grief workshop. And then later on, we've got laughing yoga, which is kind of another way of approaching